Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And you're hearing music, there it is, from the 1943 film adaptation of Ernest Hemingway's classic novel, For Whom the Bell Tolls, starring Gary Cooper and Ingrid Bergman.
I'm in this war to the finish. I can't have anything serious in my life. A man doing what I'm doing never knows what's going to happen.
Whatever happens to you will happen to me.
Well, the movie did in part happen to Bergman because of Hemingway himself. Here's Ingrid Bergman in a 1971 interview describing her introduction to the literary giant.
I didn't know him and received this great surprise and opened the book, and inside he had written, "You are the Maria in this book."
Hemingway also wrote letters to Bergman telling her he hoped she would star in For Whom the Bell Tolls. He wrote those letters while living at Finca Valleja, his home in Cuba, for more than 20 years.
Now, history and political tension between the U.S. and Cuba have long shrouded that part of Hemingway's life. But today, the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library announced that it's receiving 2,000 new digitized images of Hemingway's papers and personal effects, specifically from his years in Cuba. It's a result of a unique agreement between the Cuban Council of National Heritage and the Boston-based Finca Vigía Foundation. Joining us now to talk a little bit more about this is Sandra Spanier. She's professor of English at Pennsylvania State University and the general editor of the Hemingway Letters Project, which is producing the Cambridge edition of The Letters of Ernest Hemingway. Sandra Spanier, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So first of all, take us into Finca Vigía as a place itself. Describe it to us and what first drew Ernest Hemingway there.
Well, Finca Vigía is in a small town outside of Havana, San Francisco de Paula, and when he had been traveling to Cuba throughout the 30s to fish in the Gulf Stream, he went to cover the Spanish Civil War, and at the end of the war, his marriage to Pauline Pfeiffer was sort of on the rocks, and he was beginning, more than beginning, a relationship with Martha Gellhorn, and she joined him, Martha, in Cuba, and she found a kind of rundown house outside of Havana and rented it for them. When he sold the book rights of For Whom the Bell Tolls to Paramount Pictures, he decided to buy the place, and he bought it in December of 1940. It's now a national museum, and it has a lot of treasures in it.
And I'm sorry to interrupt, but as you had mentioned, the book rights For Whom the Bell Tolls is what gave him the money to buy Finca Vigía. And in the, 20-some years that he was there or lived there, he also wrote A Movable Feast and The Old Man and the Sea. So an important location in terms
of the
literature that came out of period in Hemingway's life.
He really lived there for a third of his life, and it's a portion of his life that biographers outside of Cuba have not known too much about. It, the access has been a problem, of course, and the papers that we have now, in 1961, in August, a month after his suicide and 4 months after the Bay of Pigs invasion, when U.S.-Cuba relations were at a low point, Mary Hemingway, his fourth wife and widow, got special permission from both the U.S. and Cuban government to go to Cuba, go to the home, Finca Vigía, and bring out some of their belongings. So she brought out a boatload of papers and belongings. Those papers have formed the bulk of the Kennedy Library's Hemingway collection. But what we've not known is what she left behind in Cuba. Mm-hmm. And as a result of this cooperative agreement, in 2008, the first wave of documents came out, conserved so that the originals are preserved as part of the Hemingway Museum's collection in Cuba, but also scanned, digitized, and given to the Kennedy Library in Boston, where they are accessible to scholars around the world. What we have now is the second wave of those documents that has just come out.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about what's in that second wave in just a moment, but I should note that the reason why this gift has been given to the John F. Kennedy Library, I mean, you sort of hinted at it, but it's worth talking in a little bit more directly. Due to direct intervention by President Kennedy himself, if I understand correctly, after Hemingway's suicide in 1961, even though tensions were so high between the U.S.
Right.
and Cuba.
Right. Well, he greatly admired Hemingway, and the feeling was mutual.
Well, so tell us a little bit more about then what's in this second trove of documents. I see that it's things that she left behind originally, but these are exactly the things that give us insight into sort of the minute details of day-to-day life that Ernest Hemingway experienced while living at Finca Vigía.
That's right. Biographers, historians create a picture of the past by artifacts, by seeing what survives, the evidence, and sort of connecting the dots to fill in the picture. And we just have an amazingly eclectic range of documents there. One of the earliest ones is a receipt from a Hotel Taube in Schruns, Austria, from 1925-26, when he traveled there with his first wife, Hadley, and their son, Bumby. And it has Bumby's milk consumption by the day, that kind of minutia. But then you also have a speech he wrote in Spanish upon accepting a Cuban medal for the Old Man and the Sea in 1952. We knew that this speech existed. The New York Times reported that he had been given this medal in September of 52 and that he had accepted the medal in a speech in Spanish. But now we have the actual typescript of the speech where he apologizes first for Spanish, first of all, and then accepts the medal in the name of all the marlin fishermen of the north coast of Cuba, from Puerto Escondido to Bahía Honda, living and dead. So he also uses colloquial Spanish. His grammar isn't perfect, but it shows the extent to which he really was integrated into Cuban life. His friends were common fishermen, and they loved him back.
Mm-hmm. And I read the Boston Globe reports that the collection includes also things like Ernest Hemingway's instruction to household staff on how to prepare his hamburgers: ground beef, onions, garlic, India relish, and capers cooked so the edges were crispy, but the center red and juicy. I mean, that gives us insight
That's
into
right.
his culinary taste, for example. But
That's
also
actually his wife's recipe, because of his celebrity, magazines wanted to know things like how to like his hamburgers. But you do get those that texture of daily life. There are instructions, again in Spanish, to the Finca staff, of very detailed. When they're out of the country, they're going to Europe in the winter of 1948, details of what plants to plant where, clean up the fallen mangoes and the dead frogs from the property, the care of the cats, the animals, particularly what he called the named animals, because he had 50-some cats. There were particular favorites, and he wanted them to have particular care. We get that there are workers' insurance policies that name the staff and their salaries, insurance papers for the cars that he owned in Cuba. So it's just that these details that enrich our picture, that add texture, nuance to the portrait we have of Hemingway, and do fill in that aspect of daily life in Cuba.
Well, for you, I mean, you're a scholar of Hemingway's life and writings. You're the editor of the Hemingway Letters Project. Was there anything in particular from this new trove of documents and personal effects that shed light on this giant of American literature that maybe we hadn't known or understood fully before?
Well, there are some very sweet, affectionate notes to his wife, Mary, that weren't even identified as Hemingway notes or letters, because one of them is signed Big Kitten. They called each other Kitten. That was their mutual nickname. And there's another one that is actually, it's a printed greeting card, but it's signed with drawings of cat paws. And again, with love from Kitten. Those kinds of things sort of rock the stereotypes of Hemingway as the chest-thumping, big game hunter, sport fisherman, and really show a different side of him. There are weather observations in a notebook, very detailed, barometric pressure by the hour as he's tracking hurricanes. There's a letter to Ingrid Bergman in 1941, basically talking about plans for this picture of For Whom the Bell Tolls. And he says to her, all this is confidential. I write it to you so you'll know that we've not given up hope of having you play the girl. There is no one that I would rather see do it, and I have consistently refused all suggestions that I endorse other people for the role. So we see that aspect as well.
Well, Sandra Spanier is a professor of English at Penn State University and the general editor of the Hemingway Letters Project. It's producing a Cambridge edition of the Letters of Ernest Hemingway. Sandra Spanier, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And I should also add that Sandra spoke to us in regards to a new trove of 2,000 digitized images from the personal collection and documents of Ernest Hemingway from his years in Cuba that's been gifted to the John F. Kennedy Library in Dorchester.
And that's our program for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.